Imagine cooling your home all summer with almost no electricity, using a machine with no compressor and no moving parts, powered by nothing but heat. That machine is not a dream. It cooled the New York Stock Exchange in 1903. It refrigerated farmhouses in the 1930s on a cup of kerosene, and the same ammonia-driven cycle still air conditions buildings today. It makes cold directly out of heat, runs in near silence, and can last for decades. Then, for American homes, it nearly disappeared, erased so completely that we now assume staying cool means a compressor and a brutal power bill every July. So why did we stop cooling our homes with ammonia? And who profited the moment we switched to the system humming outside your window right now? Let's find out. Making cold without electricity is older than the power grid that runs your refrigerator today, and the story of how it works begins not with an engineer trying to cool a home, but with a chemist who nearly blinded himself. In 1823, a young Michael Faraday was working in a London laboratory, heating a strange compound inside a sealed, bent glass tube. As he worked, he noticed something that would quietly underpin every cooling machine that followed. When he trapped certain gases in that tube and heated one end, the vapor traveled to the cold end and condensed into a liquid. And when that liquid was allowed to evaporate again, it pulled a startling amount of heat out of everything around it, growing brutally cold. As the tube blew up in his face, irritating his eyes, he had stumbled onto the principle still applied in every chiller today. One of the substances Faraday liquefied that year was ammonia. And ammonia, it turned out, was almost perfectly designed for this trick. Evaporate it, and it produces intense cold. Compress it or absorb it back into water, and you can use it all over again, in a sealed loop, forever. For three decades, this stayed a curiosity. Then a French engineer named Ferdinand Carré took the principle and built it into a working machine. In 1858, he developed a system that used water as the absorbent and ammonia as the refrigerant, patenting it in France in 1859 and in the United States a year later. It made real ice in real quantity. By 1862, he was exhibiting a machine at the London Exhibition that could produce 200 kilograms of ice an hour. Think about what that meant. This was decades before the electric compressor existed, before most homes had electricity at all. Carré was manufacturing ice in the summer heat using nothing but a fire, some water, and ammonia's strange willingness to carry cold. The cold, impossibly, came out of the heat. All that remained was to shrink that machine down small enough to carry into a farmhouse kitchen. The man who put this laboratory principle into American kitchens was not a scientist at all. He was a salesman named Powell Crosley Jr., a Cincinnati manufacturer sometimes called the Henry Ford of radio, who had already made a fortune putting cheap radios into ordinary homes. And Crosley saw a market that everyone selling electric refrigerators was ignoring. In 1925, only 3% of American farms had electricity. Think about what that meant for the family on those farms. The electric refrigerator was just arriving in the cities, humming away in well-wired kitchens, but to the millions of households beyond the reach of the power lines, it was useless. They were still keeping milk in a spring house and watching meat spoil in the summer heat. They had no grid, and the grid was not coming for years. So Crosley bought the rights to an absorption cooler patented by a Toronto inventor, and in 1928, he began manufacturing it under a name that captured the whole idea in a word, the Icy Ball. It sold for about $80 complete with a 4.25 cubic foot cabinet, and Crosley declared 22,000 sales in the first year alone. The device itself was almost absurdly simple to look at. Two metal balls joined by a U-shaped pipe, one ball holding water, the other holding ammonia, with the gas free to travel between them. No motor, no compressor, no wires. It operated silently, with no moving parts of any kind. And here is the part the marketing leaned on hardest, printed right across the advertisements. The whole thing ran on a cup of kerosene. Charged each morning, it would run. Before we continue, the honest truth about salt cooling is all linked below. Tap the link, grab the book, and it's in your inbox. Run for a day on about a cup of fuel, giving rural homes without electricity the full benefit of refrigeration. The promise in the ads was blunt and astonishing for its time, a constant ice supply for about 2 cents a day. This was not a prototype or a science fair gadget. It was a mass market consumer product that sold in serious numbers, was exported to France, Germany, Switzerland, and beyond, and gave the family at the end of a dirt road the same cold storage a city kitchen had. For a few short years, the future of refrigeration looked like it might not need the grid at all. But how could a flame and some ammonia possibly cool anything at all? The chemistry is the clever part. So, how does a flame and some ammonia actually cool a room? To see it, follow what happens inside the sealed loop, because this is where heat quietly turns itself into cold. The heart of the system is the same pairing in every version, from the farmhouse icy ball to a building-sized chiller, ammonia and water. Ammonia loves water. It dissolves into it greedily, the way sugar vanishes into hot tea, and the cooling cycle is really just the story of driving them apart and letting them rush back together. It begins with heat, and this is the part that surprises people. You apply a flame, a gas burner, or any hot source to a chamber of ammonia-rich water. As it heats, the ammonia is driven back out of the water as a pressurized gas because heat breaks the bond between them. That ammonia gas travels to a condenser, where it sheds its heat and condenses into pure liquid ammonia. You have used heat to load a spring. Now the cooling stroke. That liquid ammonia is released into a low-pressure chamber called the evaporator, and there it does what Faraday first witnessed. It evaporates, and evaporating ammonia is violently heat-hungry. To turn back into a gas, it rips heat out of everything around it, growing brutally cold. Run the air of your home across that frigid evaporator, and you have air conditioning. The heat that was in your room is now locked in the ammonia gas, which drifts onward to dissolve back into its waiting water, ready to begin again. That is the entire trick. And notice what's missing. There is no compressor doing the work an electric motor would normally do. The heat itself is the engine. The same ammonia and water cycle endlessly inside a sealed system, and the only thing the machine consumes is a source of warmth, fuel, waste, heat, or even the sun. A small version of this chilled a farmhouse icebox on a cup of kerosene. A large version, fed by a steam boiler, could chill an entire building. The principle scales effortlessly from a lunchbox to a skyscraper. The cycle is elegant on paper. The real question is whether anyone actually cooled real rooms this way. They did, and on a scale you would never guess. Here's the fact that should stop you. The first air conditioning ever installed to cool people, not machines, opened at the New York Stock Exchange in 1903, and it ran on three ammonia absorption machines, each with a cooling capacity equal to 150 tons of ice. Read that again. Before the electric compressor air conditioner existed in any practical form, ammonia driven by heat was cooling one of the most important rooms in American finance. The trading floor of the stock exchange was kept comfortable by absorption cooling, the exact cycle that would later sit inside a farmhouse icy ball. This was not a gadget. It was the foundation of climate control itself. And the technology kept proving itself at every scale. In the home, the same absorption principle, built into a cabinet, became a genuine mass-market success under a name most people have never heard, Serval. From 1927 until 1956, Serval was the only American manufacturer of gas absorption refrigerators, and for years it simply dominated the market, its competition all but vanishing. These ran on a small flame instead of a compressor, and they had one feature no electric unit of the era could match. They were silent. A period advertisement spelled out the difference plainly. Gas refrigerators were quieter because they had no noisy compressor. No motor kicking on in the night, no moving parts to wear out, machines families handed down for decades. The scale was not small. Electrolux, whose absorption design Serval built under license, introduced an air-cooled version in 1931, and by 1936, more than 1 million had been sold. And the technology was explicitly being pushed toward whole-home climate control. By 1933, year-round air conditioning of homes was being publicly demonstrated, and engineers were building multi-stage ammonia absorption machines aimed squarely at comfort cooling. So step back and look at what existed by the mid-1930s. A cooling technology with no moving parts, that ran on cheap fuel or waste heat, that needed no electricity to cool, that ran silently and lasted for generations, that had already air-conditioned a major building and was being engineered for the home. By every measure that should matter, it wasn't just viable, it was excellent. Proven, silent, durable, and electricity-free. So how did a technology this good nearly vanish from American homes? The answer starts with a danger nobody could ignore. Now here's the part no one selling you nostalgia will mention. The icy ball and the gas refrigerator had a real, serious problem. And it was the same property that made them work. Ammonia. Ammonia is toxic. Breathe a concentrated lungful of it, and it burns your airways. A large leak in an enclosed space can kill. And in the 1920s, ammonia was not even the worst of the refrigerants in people's kitchens. The early fridges of that decade were charged with substances we now consider nightmares. Sulfur dioxide, which sears the lungs, and methyl chloride, which is both poisonous and flammable. These chemicals were sealed inside machines sitting in family homes, and the seals were not always perfect. When one of those early refrigerators leaked, people were poisoned in their sleep. There are documented cases from the 1920s of families sickened, and some killed, by refrigerant escaping silently in the night. A leaking fridge could be a quiet executioner, and the public knew it. Refrigeration in that era carried a genuine, justified fear that the cold box in the corner might be holding something deadly. And the broader anxiety of the time was stoked by disasters that made toxic gas a national headline. On the 15th of May, 1929, nitrocellulose X-ray film ignited in the basement of the Cleveland Clinic, releasing a poisonous yellow-brown gas that spread through the building and killed 123 people. Victims collapsed at their desks. Some died within minutes, others days later from the fumes they had inhaled. That fire was about film, not refrigerators. But it seared something into the public and regulatory mind, invisible toxic gas, escaping through the ducts of a building, killing people where they stood. In a decade already nervous about the chemicals in their iceboxes, the message landed hard. Some historians argue the disaster helped accelerate the search for a refrigerant that was neither poisonous nor flammable. So, the case against the old refrigerants was not invented. It was real, and it was urgent. A technology that depended on toxic, sometimes flammable chemicals sitting in millions of homes was a genuine public safety problem that demanded a genuine solution. Anyone who tells you the gas refrigerator was perfect and was murdered purely out of greed is lying to you. The danger was real. But here is where the story turns. The solution that arrived to replace it and the company that profited beyond imagination from selling it is the part that got quietly buried. Here's where the money enters the story. In 1928, General Motors had a problem. Its refrigerator division, Frigidaire, was losing money, and the toxic refrigerants scaring the public were a barrier to selling cooling to every home in America. So GM's research chief assigned a brilliant, reckless chemist named Thomas Midgley Jr. to find a refrigerant that was neither poisonous nor flammable. In 1928, Midgley's team demonstrated a new compound, a chlorofluorocarbon, and showed off its stability and apparent non-toxicity. Then came the showmanship. At the 1930 meeting of the American Chemical Society, Midgley walked on stage with a candle, inhaled a lungful of the new gas, and gently exhaled it across the flame, snuffing it out. The message to the audience was unmistakable. It would not poison you, and it would not burn. He called it Freon. And here is the move that decided the next 80 years of how America stays cool. In 1930, General Motors and DuPont jointly formed a company called Kinetic Chemicals to produce and sell Freon. Two of the most powerful industrial giants in the country now had a patented, proprietary refrigerant and an enormous financial interest in putting it in every home. The result was not a fair fight. Within 5 years, Frigidaire and other makers using Freon had blown the competition out of the market, selling more than 8 million refrigerators. The compressor needed Freon, and the grid was now spreading to power it. The gas absorption refrigerator, the silent, electricity-free machine, was reframed as the obsolete past. The marketing muscle of GM and DuPont, the spread of cheap electricity, and a patented chemical they alone controlled together, pushed the icy ball and its silent cousins out of the American home. And now for the part that should make you sit back. The safe miracle that replaced toxic ammonia turned out to be a catastrophe of a different kind. In 1974, two scientists revealed that those stable CFC molecules drift to the upper atmosphere and destroy ozone, the layer that shields all life from ultraviolet radiation. By the Montreal Protocol of 1987, Freon and its relatives were banned worldwide. So the refrigerant sold as the safe answer tore a hole in the sky. The old technology didn't fail on merit. It was simply less profitable to a pair of corporations who owned the alternative. which raises the obvious question, could it work again? Here's where this technology actually lives right now, because the truth is, it never died. It just got pushed to the edges of the map, to the places the grid forgot and the buildings too big to cool cheaply any other way. Start small. If you've ever owned a camper or an RV, you've likely already used the Icy Ball's direct descendant. The refrigerator in the back runs the same ammonia absorption cycle on a propane flame, with no compressor and often no electricity, which is exactly why it's there, miles from any outlet. The brands that build them, Dometic and Norcold, are running century-old chemistry, sealed far more safely than a 1930s dumbbell ever was. But for cooling actual rooms and buildings, the technology scales up dramatically. Large commercial buildings are often cooled by gas-fired absorption chillers, machines that make chilled water using heat instead of an electric compressor. And they shine in one situation above all, anywhere heat is going spare. An absorption chiller can run on waste steam from a boiler, gas turbine exhaust, or a biomass burner, turning heat that would otherwise be thrown away straight into cooling. A factory, a hospital, a data center with surplus heat can air condition itself with energy it was about to waste. And here is the part that closes the circle. The very same ammonia water absorption that cooled the stock exchange in 1903 is now paired with solar thermal collectors, using the heat of the sun itself to drive the cooling. Think about that. The hotter the day, the more cooling you generate. It's the perfect inversion of everything we assume about air conditioning, and it runs on the one thing a hot summer has in abundance. This is the key to understanding where absorption belongs. The electric compressor wins when you have cheap, abundant power and nothing else. Absorption wins the moment that flips, when you have heat but not electricity. Off-grid homes, propane homesteads, sun-baked regions, and any large building swimming in waste heat. With pressure on the electrical grid and decarbonization efforts rising, absorption cooling in efficient hybrid systems is being called genuinely promising again. One honest caution, this is not a garage build. Ammonia under pressure is dangerous, and a modern absorption unit is hermetically sealed and factory built for good reason. The way to use this today is to buy a properly engineered system, not to recreate Crosley's open flame in your living room. So, once you know where it fits, the only question left is whether it belongs in your home. And the honest answer, as always, depends on where you live and what you have to work with. If you're on the grid in an ordinary house, a modern electric heat pump is almost certainly your most efficient way to cool, and nobody should tell you otherwise. The compressor genuinely did improve, and for the wired home, it's hard to beat. Absorption cooling is not a nostalgia act to force into a situation that doesn't call for it. But the moment your situation changes, so does the answer. An off-grid home, a propane homestead, a cabin where a power line costs a fortune, a sun-drenched region with more sunlight than grid. In those places, an absorption system isn't a compromise, it's the right tool, making cold from fuel or sunlight instead of a meter, silently, with almost nothing inside it to break. And if you run a building with heat going to waste, absorption cooling is close to free air conditioning hiding in plain sight, which is exactly why it's quietly coming back. But step back and look at the larger shape of what happened, because this is the part that should stay with you. A cooling technology that worked, that ran on cheap fuel or waste heat, that needed no electricity, that lasted for generations and made no sound, and that air conditioned a major building before the compressor could cool a closet, was not beaten in a fair fight. It was outspent. Two corporations owned a patented chemical. The grid arrived to favor the machine that chemical fed, and the silent flame-powered cooler was quietly rebranded as the past. And the safe chemical that won went on to burn a hole in the sky over the entire planet. The physics never stopped being true. Heat one end, cool the other. Faraday saw it in a glass tube 200 years ago, the stock exchange ran on it in 1903, and the chiller in a modern hospital still proves it today. The cold was always available in the chemistry. We simply chose, or were sold, the version someone could put a meter on. Ammonia cooling didn't lose because it was bad. It lost because nobody could own the heat of a flame the way DuPont could own Freon. If this is the kind of forgotten engineering you want more of, the kind that hands a little independence back to you, then subscribing and sharing keeps it findable. And if you want to see how to cool a humid room for about $25 with nothing but salt, watch our video on the salt cooler right here.